Welcome to Life, Death, and the Law, presented by the law firm of Deason, Garner, and Hanson, hosted by attorneys Sean Garner and Adam Hanson.
Welcome back to Life, Death, and the Law. I'm attorney Adam Hanson. I've got my good friend Cody Beeson with me today. And I don't know about you, but we tend to listen to a man named Jordan Peterson. If you haven't heard of him or listen to his stuff, he's very articulate. He is a psychologist. He's Canadian, so don't hold that against him. But he's still really good to listen to because he has such profound insight. Well, Sean sent us a clip of Jordan talking about his analysis of both candidates, Trump and Harris, this last week. And I thought it would be insightful to listen to that, to watch that. And as we're doing that, we'll throw in our commentary.
You've got two complete polar opposites now running for president of the United States. If you were psychoanalyzing Trump and Kamala Harris, what would you conclude right now based on everything you've seen and heard?
Well, if I could vote in the American election, I would vote for Trump. And I don't trust Harris. Now, do I trust Trump? Well, he was president for 4 years. Like, look, the best predictor of someone's future behavior is their past behavior. If you're trying to hire someone and you have documented history of their efforts in precisely the domain that you're attempting to hire for, and the evidence is clear and valid, you use that in favor of all other predictive, what would you say, predictive markers. So I think it's more appropriate for me as a clinician who knows the psychometric literature to point out that independent of Trump's personality, which tends, by the way, to be a relatively weak predictor of behavior, it's intelligence that's the best predictor, and then personality. We have a documented track record. Okay, so what do we know about Trump? Well, as far as I'm concerned, we know this. Decent economic performance, markedly stable international situation, no wars, plus, and that's something, no wars. Plus, he established the Abraham Accords, and they've held even after October 7th, and everybody in the State Department told the Trump administration that that was, that putting that agreement together was impossible. Now, of course, it's the Abraham Accords that have infuriated and frustrated the bad actors in Iran, and that's pretty much the entire political class there, and fomented October 7th and produced this catastrophe that's unfolding. But putting that at the feet of Donald Trump is a very ill-advised thing to do. So I would say, with regards to Trump, well, we know what a Trump presidency would be like, but there's something else to consider too, because you might say, well, you know, that was round one and now it's round two and Trump is older. And although I think he's actually modified his behavior to some degree as a consequence of being beat up so thoroughly over the last 5 years, and although he's a bit defensive, he's also less blustery and more human, which I think is a big plus. But for me, the other thing that I've seen really switch that's really been positive for me is that Trump has pulled a lot of hyper-powerful people together around him. Musk, Tulsi Gabbard, Vivek Ramaswamy, Robert F. Kennedy, most of whom would have been Democrats in anything approximating a sane and normal world. And so, you see, my sense is that somebody whose narcissistic impulses are out of control, because Trump is a flamboyant and dominating character who likes the public light. So you think, well, you know, does he tilt too far in the narcissistic direction? It's like, well, why would he share the spotlight with the rest of this crew? And the other thing that we should consider is that, look, man, I would vote for Trump if for no other reason than Musk himself has already agreed to head something like a Department of Governmental Efficiency in the U.S. It's like, okay, enough said. You know, and then Kennedy is bringing the public health crisis into the political realm, and both those two things are revolutionary.
I would also say
Ramaswamy seems to be...
Ramaswamy is a very smart guy as well. I completely agree with you on that. Also, I think that Trump has shown with these assassination attempts something very surprising that I suspect a lot of people would not have expected, and that is genuine personal courage. I mean, the first time when he was actually shot, to insist on getting back up and to punch the air defiantly was a remarkable thing to do. But I thought remarkably was a week later, he was back on stage at another rally with an even bigger crowd, like nothing had happened. I spoke to him at night and he was, you know, very gung-ho. I'm just going to keep doing it. They're not going to stop me. That is personal moral courage. I don't think you ever know whether you have it until it happens. And then you saw again with this latest one, you know, he was cracking jokes immediately afterwards, saying, well, I wish I could have finished my birdie putt. The reaction, I mean, it's a quality of Trump that we haven't really seen until you see it. And you're never quite sure how people will respond when there are genuine threats to kill them. And he's actually been shot and then nearly got killed again. And yet he's back out there continuing with the campaigning. So whatever you think of Trump, I do think on the personal courage aspect, he's shown a lot of it recently.
Yes, grace under pressure, but also you pointed to something else, is that he was up cracking jokes. You know, Hitler wasn't well known for his sense of humor. Mm. And the thing about Trump, and you can't deny this, Trump is a funny bastard.
Right.
He's funny. He'll say daring things just because they're comical. He's really good at it. And even his Twitter usage, his ex usage, Twitter, of course, because he's not really using the platform now. Impulsive, entertaining, unbelievably cutting and funny in a stand-up comedian sort of manner. And, you know, that just doesn't go well with the tyrannical personality, because tyrants aren't well known for being able to tolerate the court jester, let's put it that way. And so Trump is tough and funny. The other thing about Trump you got to think about too is, you know, is he ambitious? Well, I don't think it's ambition that's driving his pursuit of this second term. I mean, first of all, Trump's an old man, and second of all, he's already president and he's as famous as you can get. And you might say, well, his ambition is so overweening that, you know, it's compelling him forward regardless. And I don't actually think so. I actually think that what happened was that Trump accidentally became president, shocked the hell out of him. And then he got some sense of exactly how unstable and corrupt the DC swamp had become. And he started to take the role seriously. And now I think he's taking it even more seriously. And that's part of why he's building this coalition. I think he made a dreadful mistake in the debate with Kamala Harris because, well, first of all, he didn't highlight the Biden laptop spectacle, which is like a bit of political maneuvering that outdoes any deviance that I've ever seen since the beginning of my political awareness, including everything that went around Richard Nixon, who was impeached for his much lesser sins. Trump has gathered these people around him and he's ready to move forward. Now, he didn't make a case for that in the damn debate.
I thought he was I thought that she played him rather cleverly. She played to his narcissism, let's call it, I think, what it is a bit, about the crowd sizes, about all that kind of stuff. And rather than him laser-like focusing on her weakness, which is that after 4 years, the country clearly is not in a better place. That's why she couldn't answer that question. And skewering her on her actual paucity of policy knowledge. I mean, she doesn't seem to know what she would do if she ran the country. She sort of played into his hands of allowing himself to be goaded and getting into a bit of a street fight and then saying crazy stuff about cats and dogs and so on and so on. Conversely, if you were looking at her right now, how do you psychoanalyze Kamala Harris?
Okay, well, let's give the devil his due to begin with. One of the marked things I have seen happening with the Democrats since this switch in leadership is their movement away from the radical left. And so I'd like to give them credit for that. I think, now, is it real? Well, maybe. Some of me doesn't care if it's real, even if it's performative, even if it's purely performative, it's long overdue and very welcome. And so you don't hear Kamala talking much about the climate crisis, which I'm perfectly happy about because I think that's an absolute load of anti-human rubbish in the main. And the more leftist types within the Democrat Party have been effectively sidelined, at least as this campaign has progressed. So, you know, thumbs up on that regard. Having said that, on the principle that previous performance is the best indicator of future performance, Kamala's had her time in the White House. Now, you might say the vice presidency is a secondary role, but if you're the sort of person that would only allow the vice presidency to be a secondary role, then maybe you're not fit to be president. You don't have enough force of character. And we've already seen what a Biden administration looks like. And what I see the Biden administration look like, I mean, America is such an economic powerhouse that it's still trudging along, rampaging along like a bull in a china shop, like it always does. But foreign policy has been a complete bloody world-ending disaster under the Democrats. They haven't stood up to Iran, which is a pack of vipers without compare. And we have this terrible, brutal, and I think unnecessary war going on between Russia and Ukraine, which could spiral out of control at any moment and is highly likely to. And so that's on Harris and the Democrats, and that's a major issue. So, and then what we might say, well, what will we get under Kamala? And maybe it's the case that the move away from the radical left is real, although I'd need a lot more evidence before I would believe that. But the easiest thing to predict is another 4 years of the same thing.
Yeah.
Like, why wouldn't you predict that? It's not like she's the only one calling the shots. And as you already pointed out, maybe we could have more confidence that she would be a transformative leader, pull the Democrats to the center. What would you say? Act in a stellar manner on the foreign policy front and put the economy in order. Well, we'd be a lot more convinced of that if she was 10 times more policy oriented than she appears to be.
I completely agree. Yeah.
Yeah. I've never seen a candidacy focused so much on image in my life in any country.
Well, Cody, what do you think? So we just got done listening to an interview between Piers Morgan and Jordan Peterson, and it was pretty broken down as far as what
I'm confused.
Dr. Peterson believes. What are you confused about?
I thought Piers Morgan was liberal.
Oh, really? You haven't been watching his stuff lately?
Oh, man. He is very... his eyes are open, it seems like. Everything Jordan Peterson talked about was you could not disagree with. Like, it is all based in fact. But I really did not remember Piers Morgan being that middle of the road. Or intellectually honest. How about that?
Well, I've been watching him for quite a while, and that's what I've experienced. And I kind of enjoy it because he does, from time to time, he'll throw in more left-leaning things, but that's fine. I mean, I want to hear all these voices. I want to hear these opinions. As it regards Trump and Harris, what I hear Jordan to say is that past behavior is the strongest indicator of future performance. And he said, psychologically, a person's personality is a very weak indicator of performance, of their behavior.
But their history.
Yeah, rather you would focus on history. And so from that perspective alone, which is a pretty, you know, straightforward, very logical type argument, I can see where he's coming from. The thought that I had echoes what Peterson was saying in the sense of, I often think to myself, if I were to, I have friends that are going to vote for Harris. And I asked one the other day, I asked, is there anything that you could be told or see that would change your opinion to have you vote for Trump? And she said, no. And I said, that's what I assumed, because I feel the same way. I'm kind of set in what I'm going to do and how I'm going to vote. And at this point, I don't have any, there will be nothing that will sway that vote because I'm locked in already. And I imagine that's how the other side is. And I just confirmed that with her because I was thinking to myself, that's how I feel. So I imagine somebody that has an opposite opinion of me, that they have that opinion and they're just going to do that. To me, to that person, what I would say is, I'm not worried about, I don't see it as a Trump versus Harris. I see it as a Trump team versus a Harris team. I'm not so concerned about Trump or Harris as much as I'm concerned about the people that will surround them. And when I see Trump surrounding himself with Ramaswamy, with RFK Jr., with Tulsi Gabbard, with, I know you love Tulsi, Cody.
She has it put together.
Right. With Elon Musk. I think that was... Yeah. Awesome that he came out saying, I'll appoint you as my efficiency czar You know, we don't have that yet, but let's create this agency of the government that will cannibalize our own government. It will just go to town, cutting agencies, cutting funding.
Doesn't that seem too good to be true?
It does.
Like, to have an efficiency czar in the government, like, that doesn't even seem to go together.
I didn't even actually put it all together or think of it too deeply until yesterday. Yeah. And I thought to myself, once I realized what they've been talking about doing, and because at first all I heard them say is we're just creating another government agency, and I thought, I hate agencies. We've talked about that over and over again on the show. I just do not like the idea of a government agency because they tend to be out of touch and no sense, no way of us as the people being able to demand justice when they do something wrong to us. They are the judge, the jury, and the executioner. So when I hear, oh, we're going to create another agency, my first inclination is to recoil and to not be excited about that. But then once I thought it through, I thought, well, if we can create another agency at the expense of all these other that is going to cannibalize or just destroy and take away hundreds of agencies, then I'm okay with that. One for 100 or 1,000 or 3,000 agencies, that'd be great. Just get rid of them and let the freedom come back to the people.
I mean, if anybody knows about cost overruns and inefficiency, Elon would with the NASA stuff that they're dealing with. I mean, he got a fraction of the available funds. I should say he did, but SpaceX did versus what Boeing did. And Boeing's been failing. And we see them fail all over the place. And yet they're still receiving more funds than these smaller companies. Like
absolutely.
Blue Origin. Yeah.
Another point that Jordan brought up was the assassination attempts. Yeah. You know, the first one was a big deal, I thought. I felt like that first one, because it was on public airwaves, you were able to witness it in real time, this actual event. And it was pretty shocking. And Trump's reaction to that, it was organic. I know right afterwards the left was saying it was all planned and it was all, you know, like this was staged and things. But I think the average person that watches that, you can see that is not acted out. That is not staged. When I watched the debate between Trump and Harris, I felt like Harris's performance was staged. That was a coached, memorized response by Harris, like a Hollywood actor would do. And she did great. She did fantastic at doing it. Let's not be mincing words about that. She actually nailed it. But it was all rehearsed and memorized, and she was prepared for that. I think that is a staged performance. But when I saw that first assassination attempt, that it was obvious that was organic. That was happening in real time. And that was his organic response to just almost dying. And the reaction was to get up and fight, right? So I think that swayed a lot of people. But at the same time, it feels like that is so far in the past that we don't talk about it anymore. It's like it didn't even happen. And I don't know. What do you think? What's your opinion on that? Am I wrong?
I think there is a narrative in this country that they're trying to move past, and that being one of them, because that was a strong moment for him. You know, he got up, he said fight, he's still alive. And I think anybody that's pro-Harris wants to make you forget about that.
I think the sentiment was, I mean, when I saw that, I'm like, oh, well, like, he automatically wins, right? We don't even need an election. I mean, if somebody tries to kill you and they're that close, it's like, okay, you win. You get the presidency. Like, yeah. you survived that, you know, you win. That's what my initial thought was. Is like, why are we even doing this now? But at the time, actually, it was Biden, though.
Yeah.
Biden was the nominee. I forgot about that.
I mean,
already, see how things changed so much that we've already forgotten. You know, bait and switch.
And within 2 weeks of Biden, you know, or not even 2 weeks, less than that, it went from, you know, who is Kamala? Do you know, she's unimpressive, to, oh my God, she's the best.
Right.
Best thing since sliced bread.
Jordan brought that up, right? He said, I've never seen such an effort to focus on this remake or this remodel of an individual in an election. We actually have to go to break. So we'll go to a break. We'll be right back after this.
Coming up, more thought-provoking conversations on life, death, and the law right after this. You're listening to Life, Death, and the Law, presented by Deason, Garner, and Hanson, the law firm that has been voted Yuma's best 6 years in a row.
Welcome back to Life, Death, and the Law. I'm attorney Adam Hanson. I've got Cody, my good friend here. And the last segment we were talking about, or making commentary about, this interview between Piers Morgan and Jordan Peterson and the reality, or sorry, the personalities of our current presidential candidates. We gave our own opinions on that. What we're going to do now is we're going to, I think through my lifetime, I've often seen that there has been a great divide between religion and science. It's as if they don't coexist. It's either one or the other. Either science is true or religion is true. That's the sentiment that I've gotten my whole life. And would you agree with that, Cody?
I mean,
like they're constantly fighting.
Yeah. But I mean, religion, how to put it, like God created everything. So, I mean, it's tied up in there. But yeah, I remember going through public school and going through science class, and they made fun of the creation theory, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, well, that's what a religionist would say.
Yeah.
So maybe there is a fight between religion and science.
At least in the public school.
In the public square.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see. So we've got a clip I want to play from Dinesh D'Souza off of his show. He's interviewing a very, I guess, leading chemist. Martine is saying, yes, that's true. He is a leading chemist. I guess he's a rock star in the chemistry area, if that's a thing. I took chemistry in high school. That was the worst class I've ever had in my life. And I passed barely. And then I later took it at Arizona State, which you would think, you know, it's Arizona State. You just have to show up and you get a grade. But that was not the case. It was even harder. And that's when I knew at that point in time, I will not be going to med school. In fact, I would have to drop chemistry and change my major to something in liberal arts so I could be a lawyer. I guess it's the great weeder outer. Have you ever heard of this, Cody?
Right.
Yeah. So if you're going to go to med school, you have to have these classes like organic chemistry. You've got a list of classes that they want to see before you can be admitted to med school or anything in the medical realm. So that crushed my dreams. So this James Tour, good on him. He's a great chemist. He should have been a doctor. He probably would have made more money. But let's see what he's got to say about religion and the debate, religion and science.
How do you think about this issue of, if you will, science and God and the compatibility between those two?
I think the rookie says that they are incompatible. The rookie in science or the rookie in the understanding of the scriptures, where you will take a scientist who's never read the Bible, and they'll make a judgment on the Bible that there's really nothing here. They may have looked at it for 15 minutes. Can you imagine if somebody took my undergraduate organic chemistry textbook that I teach out of? It's 1,200 pages, and looked at it for 15 minutes and then said, there's nothing here. It's a bunch of nonsense. I'd be like, I'm speaking to an idiot right now. I'm speaking to an idiot. The same thing happens when somebody looks at the Bible for 15 minutes and makes a judgment call on it. I'm speaking to an idiot. And so what happens is, when you study these texts, I have never seen anything in the Bible go contrary to a fact of science. Now, I've seen it go contrary to a proposal of science, to a speculation of science, to a hypothesis of science, but never contrary to a fact of science. And these so-called hypotheses, these proposals of science change all the time, certainly on the order of decades. I mean, big things change all the time in science. So I don't see any problem between the two. And the interesting thing is that the people who would like to suggest that there are, I've challenged over and over again chemists on the origin of life. Tell me how life began. Show me the chemistry. Show me the chemistry. And it is so interesting that none of them will go toe-to-toe with me on this. And I've invited them on my YouTube channel, YouTube Dr. James Tour. I've invited them. I said, I'll come on your channel. We'll do it on a neutral channel. We'll have the discussion. Any PhD, the person who will contest with me is the person who doesn't understand chemistry. The person who understands chemistry sees that we are clueless on where life came from to begin with. We can't even define how life could have happened. Nobody can even give a proposal on how life could have occurred, might have occurred, whether it's on this planet or on any other planet, how first life might have occurred. I mean, even the very basic things we are clueless upon in science. Now, there are silly little proposals, but as soon as you start questioning how did that happen, everything withers around the edges. So for me, I don't see any problem with it.
Well, there you hear it. I kind of like this guy. I didn't think I'd be saying that after watching that, but this James Tour, he's a chemist rock star. Did you hear what he said? He wrote a 1,200-page organic chemistry book. That just confirmed what I talked about of why I was unable to pursue my dream of being a doctor.
No desire to go down that road, huh?
Yeah, I don't think I really had a desire. That's why it was so easy to give up on it. I was excited about making money that a doctor would make, but not so much about doing organic chemistry. Well, this guy, what do you think about what he said, though? I like him because he just kind of throws it out there. A person, a scientist that says that there's no correlation or that the Bible is somehow contrary to science is a rookie,
an idiot.
I've
seen where other scientists or you know, researchers, rather to be something organic or whatever their field was in. Point being is they have agreed after a while, like, look, I've been in this. There's obviously a divine creator. Like the signs are there. The fingerprints are there. You know, so I think the ones that are denying that, like he said, are kind of adolescent in their education or in their position right now. You know, the people that have established, Jordan Peterson, for example, they have clearly documented where they felt that there is a divine creator in conjunction with science. Like, it goes hand in hand.
I agree with that. I think when I've thought about this divide that tends to be there between religion and science, I've often thought to myself, well, if you look at the Bible or religion and you actually use the scientific method towards religion, you'll probably get your answer. Meaning, my understanding of the scientific method is you have a hypothesis and then you do a series of tests. You have controlled tests, you have non-controlled tests, to reach the conclusion as to whether that hypothesis was correct. I mean, I would imagine if you applied that to the Bible, for example, I'm gonna make an effort to read the Bible for the next, I don't know, 2 months. I was gonna say 1 month. That's probably not enough. 2 months seems like a long time, but you probably should be doing it every day, right, Martin? You need to do it every day, Martin. He's wagging his finger at me. He's shaking his finger at me. I thought you did. You don't read every day?
I don't read the Bible.
Oh. He says he doesn't read the Bible every day. What do you read? Science books?
Yeah.
Okay. I get that. So let's say we put together this reading plan. I'm gonna make an effort to read the Bible for the next 2 months diligently. At the end of that, I'm going to ask God through prayer if what I read was true. And I'm going to wait and listen for my answer. Do you think that's possible?
I mean, you'll find your answer one way or the other. I mean, you're going to find it within yourself.
Is that not the scientific method? So if a scientist was really not a rookie, as James Tour said, then that person would use their own scientific method against religion or... And I use the Bible. I guess there's a lot of different religions, but I mean, that one, that reminds me of a clip actually from Jordan Peterson that I really like, because he talks about the idea of truth and how you reach truth. Typically, it goes to some sort of hard evidence and written evidence. In the court of law, we need witnesses. The more witnesses or evidence that you have, then your case is going to be the strongest one that prevails. And that's really what court is about. Is I go to court, and if another attorney is going against me, my goal is to destroy their evidence in some form or fashion. We're going to impeach their witnesses. We're going to discredit their witnesses. We're going to discredit their hard evidence that they might be presenting, or just make it seem untenable or go away. If there's no evidence, then there's no crime. There's no way to go forward in a court of law. Usually we'll use witnesses as first-hand accounts. If I have a witness on the stand, Cody, and I ask that person a question, and they say, well, I ask, did you see this? No. My friend told me that he saw it. How good of a witness is that?
Well, it's hearsay, right?
That's hearsay.
Yeah, you throw it out.
So we would throw that out. Yeah. And so we aren't relying on secondhand witnesses. We need firsthand accounts of what happened. Martine, why don't you load up this clip? Because Jordan Peterson kind of alludes to this when it comes to the Bible.
The Joe Rogan Experience.
If categories dissolve, especially fundamental ones, the culture is dissolving. Because the culture is a structure of category. Mm-hmm. That's what it is.
Right.
So, and in fact, culture is a structure of category that we all share. So we see things the same way. Well, that's why we can talk. I mean, not exactly the same way, because then we'd have nothing to talk about. But roughly speaking, we have a bedrock of agreement. That's the Bible, by the way. So I just walked through the Museum of the Bible in Washington. That was very cool. It's a very cool museum.
So the structure, that's what the Bible
provides.
Yeah,
that's what I figured out. I just figured this out this week. So it was a cool thing to walk through because it's chronological. They have one floor, which is the history of the Bible.
Mm.
But it's not exactly that. It's really what it is the history of the book. Now, in many ways, the first book was the Bible. I mean, literally. Because at one point there was only one book, like as far as our Western culture is concerned, there was one book. And for a while, literally, there was only one book. And that book was the Bible. And then before it was the Bible, it was it was scrolls and it was writings on papyrus. But we were starting to aggregate written text together. And it went through all sorts of technological transformations. And then it became books that everybody could buy, the book everybody could buy, and the first one of those was the Bible. And then it became all sorts of books that everybody could buy. But all those books, in some sense, emerged out of that underlying book. And that book itself, the Bible isn't a book, it's a library. It's a collection of books. And so what I figured out was, partly because I was talking to my brother-in-law, Jim Keller, who's the world's greatest chip designer and has now designed a chip that's as powerful as the human brain, which is optimized for artificial intelligence learning, by the way. And so I talked to him about that. He said, you heard of the internet? I said, yeah, Jim, I've heard of the internet. He said, this is way more revolutionary than that. So in any case, we were talking about meaning in text because we were talking about translation and the problem of understanding text. And Jim said, the meaning of words is coded in the relationship of the words to one another. And the postmodernists make that case that all meaning is derived from the relationship between words. That's wrong because, well, what about rage? That's not words. And what about moving your hand? That's not words. So it's wrong, mm-hmm. but part of it's right because the meaning we derive from the verbal domain is encoded in the relationship between words. So now then you think, well, let's think about the relationship between words. Well, some words are dependent on other words. Some ideas are dependent on other ideas. The more ideas are dependent on a given idea, the more fundamental that idea is. That's a definition of fundamental. So now imagine you have an aggregation of texts in a civilization. You say, which are the fundamental texts? And the answer is, the texts upon which most other texts depend. And so you'd put Shakespeare way in there in English because so many texts are dependent on Shakespeare's literary revelations. And Milton would be in that category, and Dante would be in that category, at least in translation. Fundamental authors, part of the Western canon, not because of the arbitrary dictates of power, but because those texts influenced more other texts. And then you think about that as a hierarchy, okay, with the Bible at its base, which is certainly the case. Now imagine that's the entire corpus of linguistic production, all things considered. Now, how do you understand that? Like, literally, how do you understand that? The answer is, you sample it by reading and listening to stories and listening to people talk. You sample that whole domain. You build a low-resolution representation of that in your inside you. And then you listen and see through that. And so it isn't that the Bible is true. It's that the Bible is the precondition for the manifestation of truth, which makes it way more true than just true. It's a whole different kind of true. And I think this is not only literally the case, factually, I think it can't be any other way. It's the only way we can solve the problem of perception.
I really like how Jordan outlines the essence of truth there and getting down to the reality of the Bible and its texts, and that it actually drives to the reality that it is truth, you know? I thought that was really interesting. We've got to go to break. This is Life, Death, and the Law.
Coming up, more thought-provoking conversations on life, death, and the law right after this. You're listening to Life, Death, and the Law, presented by Deason, Garner, and Hanson, the law firm that has been voted Yuma's best 6 years in a row.
Welcome back to Life, Death, and Law. I'm attorney Adam Hanson. We've got Cody, my good friend, in with us today. We have been talking about lots of different things, like the government's intervention in our lives, I would argue. You've got science, religion. We talked about the Trump-Harris personality analysis by Jordan Peterson in the very first segment. We're gonna keep on this path because I recently heard something last week from Janet Yellen, who is the secretary or the treasury, right? Secretary of the Treasury. And basically she was going on a campaign tour and saying how if we elect a different person into office and they change things economically, then the whole United States economy will crash. When I heard her and these sound bites of her going around saying these types of things, I thought, you're the one causing the problem. And it just felt like fear-mongering. Well, there's another guy that I want you to hone in on. And this is a clip from John Stossel. He talks about the government's inability to actually use our taxpayer money in an efficient way.
Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich now makes videos, like I do. In fact, his Inequality Media is a lot like Stossel TV. He also covers economic topics and reaches people via social media. His videos are also seen by several million people. It's strange. Reich does what I do, except Reich is wrong about most everything.
Top progressive economist Robert Reich.
The media call Reich an economist.
Economist Robert Reich.
Robert Reich, an economist who served as labor secretary.
Reich doesn't correct them, but he doesn't have an economics degree. And his videos say silly things like this.
Do billionaires have a right to exist?
Ban billionaires, he says, because
there are only five ways to become a billionaire, and they're all bad. Number one, exploit a monopoly. Does Jeff Bezos really deserve his billions for building Amazon?
Yes, he does. I don't much like Bezos, but Amazon is wonderful. Its innovations lowered prices so much that Amazon cut inflation. Reich calls Amazon a monopoly. But the company isn't a monopoly. It has to compete with Walmart, Target, eBay, Alibaba, and more. If we choose Amazon, it's because it's cheaper or we think it's better.
Billionaires claim they deserve their riches.
Reich says billionaires don't deserve what they have because they
get money from rich relatives.
But the biggest study of millionaires finds few did. Billionaire Howard Schultz grew up in public housing. Billionaire Larry Ellison quit school to work odd jobs. He only got rich after founding Oracle. Jeff Bezos did get some money from his parents, but he grew Amazon with money from investors. For a long time, people called them crazy.
Each year it loses more money than it lost the year before.
They said Amazon wasn't viable. It would never become profitable. Capitalism rewards such risk-taking. But Reich says,
if capitalism were working properly, billionaires would have gone the way of the dodo.
But the opposite's true. Capitalism working properly creates some absurdly rich people. And that's okay, because we freely chose to give the money in exchange for stuff we want. As I've reported before,
if this represents the wealth of America, progressives would say the rich take so much that the poor just get a sliver.
They believe Hollywood scriptwriters who say,
it's a zero-sum game. Somebody wins, somebody loses. Money itself isn't lost or made. It's simply transferred.
But that's wrong.
It's not a zero-sum game. The makers who get rich by baking many more pies.
When the hated billionaires like Larry Ellison, Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, and Elon Musk get rich, they can only do it by making all of us better off.
They only kept 2.2% of the additional wealth they generated for the economy.
Actual economist Dan Mitchell.
In other words, the rest of us captured almost 98% of the benefits.
Another Reich video trashes trade.
Global trade is good for everyone. That's bunk.
Liar, liar, pants on fire. Get it? Of course trade isn't good for everyone. Nothing is. But when it comes to improving people's lives, trade's great. It helps the rich and the poor. So it allows everyone to get better products for less money. Actual economist Don Boudreau made this video about it.
None of us has a hint of how to make the majority of the things that we consume. Take this coffee, for example. The beans come from Guatemala. And they were brewed in this coffee maker from Switzerland. The container ship that carried the beans was built in Korea. It's insured by a company from London. And it's captained by a Frenchman who loves Turkish cigarettes.
Trade lets people specialize in what we do best. It's called comparative advantage. I'm good at reporting, but lousy at growing coffee beans. Coffee tastes better and costs less because someone who's good at that can do it much more efficiently than I, and I can specialize on my reporting. That comparative advantage, multiplied by millions of capitalists, makes everything more affordable. But Robert Reich says,
what if a country's comparative advantage comes from people working under dangerous or exploitative conditions?
I once asked Kenya's June Arunga.
Doesn't the United States have the responsibility to stop these companies from exploiting people in your country?
Exploiting people? Nobody in my country thinks about companies exploiting them. When there's a new company opening a factory, people are excited about it.
Trade creates opportunity. It's what's allowed a billion people to lift themselves out of poverty. Families who once survived by doing hard labor on farms now live better lives. Ignorant politicians from both parties trash trade.
All these foreign countries that are coming in and ripping us off and taking our jobs.
Yes, trade does take away some Americans' jobs, but it creates more jobs. Companies engaged in trade create 60% of America's new jobs. It's why unemployment is low today and why the number of Americans who have jobs has been rising.
You hear this rubbish all the time.
Finally, Reich says it's rubbish to say Biden's huge spending caused inflation.
Inflation is caused by too much government spending.
Bunk.
Not bunk. When politicians hand out big amounts of cash, it does cause inflation. Reich blames corporate greed.
Mega corporations raise prices to increase their profits.
Greed is constant.
Again, here's actual economist David Henderson.
If it's greed, how do we explain when prices fall? Do oil companies just suddenly decide, I'm going to be less greedy?
As the Nobel Prize-winning economist puts it,
inflation is made in Washington because only Washington can create money. And any other attribution to other groups of inflation is wrong.
As I said, Reich, even though colleges pay him to brainwash students, is wrong about most everything.
Of all developed nations, the United States has the most unequal distribution of income.
Inequality media is a catchy name, but inequality isn't bad if the poor get richer too. Inequality is not a conspiracy. It's simply what happens when people are free. Taylor Swift is a billionaire. Should our government force people to listen to me sing to make life more equal? Should government handicap Joe Rogan because he has more viewers than I do? Reich talks economic justice, but where's the justice in imposing rules that leave people less free? I wanted to ask him about that, but he refused our repeated offers of an interview. Maybe now that this video's posted, he will respond. I'll let you know if he does.
One thing that I picked up there, Cody, was this idea of one set pie. Like, the world has one set pie of money, let's say, or resources.
Finite resources.
Finite resources. And so these billionaires are bad guys because they're taking all this of this pie. I don't view it that way. I mean, in reality, and I think that's what Mr. Stossel was saying, is that it's not a stagnant pie. I only get this much, you get that much, these guys get all this, that it's just stagnant, it never changes. I disagree with that, obviously, because we are entrepreneurs, we create jobs, we bring more into the economy, so we're actually adding to the pie.
Creating another pie.
We're creating more and more pie. We're expanding the pie. So the pie continually is being expanded. And I liked that interview that John Stossel showed that he had years ago with this African lady, where she's like, we don't feel like we're being exploited. Nobody thinks about that. We think, oh, here come more new jobs, right? And I think that's indicative of most people. I think when you have a new company come to town, people are excited about it because it's going to create more jobs, make our community more vibrant and strong. And we want that. I don't think we're not thinking, oh my gosh, here they come. They're going to take more from all of us. If anything, that's the government. They take more from all of us and distribute it to people that we didn't authorize through tax means. And so I think it's really well put. What do you think?
Oh, I think you put it perfectly. I mean, at the end of the day, I see what they're doing. They're trying to paint, you know, all capitalism is being evil. There is some in there, you know. Yeah, there are some bad players, but at the end of the day, that's what keeps us growing. That's why America's a powerhouse, is our free economic system.
Well, what do you think? Do you think capitalism is bad? Do you think it's good? Think about that. We've got to go. This is all the time we have for today. This is Life, Death, and the Law.
If you have questions or want to know more about something that was discussed today, please call the law firm of Deason, Garner & Hanson at 928-783-4575 or visit YumaEstatePlanning.com.